Gain lambda squared over 4 pi. Gain of a dipole is 2.14 dB over ISO. You plug in the numbers, let me drop the... An 80 meter dipole in free space has a real effective capture area of 8,500 square feet. Oh, Josh, if your eyes operated at 80 meters and you looked at that dipole broadside, you'd see this great big black oval in space, roughly 150 feet wide, roughly 50 feet high, oval, and all the horizontally polarized energy at that frequency entering that black area of space, all of that would end up on the wire and go down the transmission line and move the S-meter on the receiver. Now, when you take that dipole that should be 132 feet long to be a half wave, and you make it 32 feet long instead, you've taken away 100 feet of its length, but you've reestablished resonance by way of the antenna tuner. And now you look at that effective capture area. Instead of 8,500 square feet, it's going to be around 8,000 square feet. It's going to be a near circle in space, but the effective area is going to be 8,000 square feet. You never lose more than half a dB. That dipole that's now one-third or one-quarter of the right length, it still is sucking energy from that large area of space. How the hell did it do that? Because the dipole has now got a Q that's 10 times higher because it's too darn small. It's got a Q of 100 instead of 10. Let me drop. When it's transmitting, it's got 10 times normal current flowing in the wire. The tips of the dipole are 10 times higher than normal voltage on the tips of the wire. It's got these great big H fields and E fields in space. And so the huge fields in space, because much higher current, much higher voltage, still occupy the same amount of area as the full half-wave dipole. It has essentially the same effective capture area. Very hard to envision. I accept that. A lot of people fall into the trap saying that if I made the dipole one-quarter of the normal length, it's going to have one-sixteenth of the normal area. Good common sense, dead wrong. We forgot about the fact that the Q went up, and the Q compensates for the effective capture area. EC2IS, is this making a little more sense? K2RIW, go ahead, Bill.
Especially the part where you say, okay, you've not dropped your gain by decreasing the size of your antenna, but you have increased the Q, so you have decreased the bandwidth, so, you know, some, you know, 100 waves need to go by before you've really sucked that power down into your feed line, I guess, the same amount of power down into your feed line. So I guess a question that then comes to mind is, okay, cell phones have high Q antennas, but quadrature amplitude modulation is a thing for cell phones that was a big innovation for cell phones. So quadrature amplitude modulation, okay, if your rise time is really that slow, how can you get anywhere near to quadrature amplitude modulation working in a high Q antenna, AC2IS?
First of all, that small antenna inside your cell phone has to cover a whole lot of various frequencies, various bands, various bandwidths. Connected to almost every one of those antennas inside of every one of your cell phones, there is a chip right at the antenna, which is an antenna tuner. So depending on which band you're on now, are you on the 900 meg band, the 1800 meg band, the 2200 meg band, and so on, that antenna tuner is establishing resonance. And has led you astray when it comes to rise time. That dipole on 80 meters, has a Q of 10, operating at 3.5 megacycles. 3.5 megacycles is roughly 300, let me think now. Yeah, roughly 300 nanoseconds is a cycle. Therefore, it's going to take 3,000 nanoseconds, 3 microseconds for its rise time. When you're putting speech in there at the millisecond rate, and you've got a rise time in the 3 microsecond region, you never know the difference. When I go up to 900 megacycles, where the frequency is roughly 1 nanosecond per cycle, and if the antenna had a Q of 10, it would take 10 nanoseconds for the rise time. If the antenna had a Q of 100, it would take 100 nanoseconds. 100 nanoseconds is 10 megacycles. The antenna can still have 10 megacycles of instantaneous bandwidth. So when you plug in the real numbers, the rise time being 10 times longer because the Q is 10 times higher, it still is rather brief period of time compared to the usual rate at which you're transmitting that signal. Rarely are you transmitting a signal that's 1 gigahertz wide at 1 gigahertz of center frequency, if you know what I mean. You couldn't do that for a whole bunch of reasons. Unless the antenna was a repeater.
Time out.
Unless the antenna was a pure 50-ohm dummy load. And there's ways you can make a super broadband antenna. A Vivaldi antenna comes close, for instance. Although you don't have enough real estate inside of a cell phone to do that. So when you plug in the real numbers for the real time, real rise times in nanoseconds, compared to the modulation rates that you're talking about, Bill, there isn't much of a conflict there. And even if there was a conflict, the next step is that that antenna tuner that you've got connected to the antenna, if you make it out of chips that can move fast enough, you can be changing the resonant frequency of the antenna during the modulation interval to take care of those rise times. I didn't say that's easy, but it's within the laws of physics to do that. AC2IS, K2IW in the TechNet.
I mean, I would understand if you're transmitting analog. It doesn't matter because you're not going to, you know, notice that rise time problem. But I think what you're saying is that in a cell phone you don't really have that rise time problem because you have tuned the resonant frequency of your antenna specifically to that one frequency at which you know, the cell tower is transmitting to the phone, or the phone is transmitting to the cell tower, so that effectively your Q is still pretty low for the one exact frequency. Is that what you're saying, or are you saying that the Q is still actually pretty high for the cell phone antenna? Because I think for cell phones nowadays, there's a lot of data going back and forth for internet traffic. And also, I'm assuming there's a lot of sort of time division multiplexing going on, and that, you know, when you're talking on the phone, you're not using anywhere near the airtime. You know, you're not transmitting full duty cycle, as it were, because you're multiplexing the transmissions of many cell phones onto the same frequency, so that you should require a much higher bandwidth than you would think for just voice transmissions. And so they need that whole QAM capability and all the bandwidth they can get. AC2IS.
First of all, Bill, the modern-day modulations, the exotic modulations, 16 QAM-like things, for instance, are really a mixture of angular modulation and amplitude modulation. And the Q of each is the same. In other words, if my antenna has a Q of 10, whether I'm doing amplitude modulation or angular modulation, in either case, I have the same amount of restriction of bandwidth. If my cell phone right now is operating at 1900 megacycles, for instance, where one cycle of 1900 megs is roughly, it's around 550 nanoseconds for one cycle. That's a very brief period of time. And so if it had a Q of 10, it would take 5 microseconds for a full rise time. 5 microseconds is an awful lot of bandwidth. I may have the numbers wrong here. So when it comes to First of all, the main thing you've got to do in order to make an efficient transmitter is that the center frequency of resonance of the antenna has to be at the carrier frequency you're operating at. It's the first thing that the antenna tuner chip at the antenna inside the cell phone is doing. If I'm at 1,841 megacycles right now, my antenna tuner chip is trying to make that antenna resonate at 1,842 megacycles. And now around that bandwidth, I have a certain amount of instantaneous bandwidth depending on Q. And so, with rare exception, the Q of the antenna is not the limiting bandwidth of what you can transmit and receive. The limiting bandwidth tends to be the noise equivalent bandwidth of the receiver and what threshold you're getting out of it. If I'm trying to transmit 10 megabits per second, it's going to take me a minimum of 10 megacycles of instantaneous receiver bandwidth. Well, 10 megacycles of bandwidth in the receiver gives you quite a bit of
repeater timeout.
Quite a bit of noise. If I had a state-of-the-art front end at a 1 dB noise figure, and I'm only trying to transmit 1 megacycle bit rate, and I got a 1 megacycle bandwidth, in theory I could have a sensitivity of minus 114 dBm plus the carrier-to-noise ratio. I could, in theory, listen to a signal of minus 104 dBm if I'm not using any of the fancy modulation schemes that really have a spread spectrum characteristic. The spread spectrum characteristic of some of these fancy modulation schemes give you extended threshold. That's the good news. The bad news is now the data rate has to be slowed down. It's a kind of digital integration, if you know what I mean. But you put it all together, the antenna is really the limiting bandwidth of the system because of its Q. Even though the Q is being raised because the antenna is too small and it's in an inefficient location in the cell phone itself. You go through the real numbers, you'll find out that the rise time, so to speak, of the antenna, with rare exception, it's not the limiting bandwidth of the system, Bill. AC2IS, K2IW, and the TechNet.
Okay, I will take your word for that. As of the moment, I don't understand why, but I think it's probably been much longer than you wanted. It's probably been a much longer time than you wanted to go by before moving on to your next topic. AC2IS.
You happen to be the last guy on the list, is why I can do this. Tommy, KD2K Kilo Golf Delta. We probably waited too long and he went to sleep. And everybody else on the list, Andy, Joe, Steve, Ray, and Santo. We covered all those people. I think it's time to go over to the space report, see what Paul's got to say. WS2N, about to give a space report number 244 of the series. K2IW, what has NASA been doing this week and what are they about to do, Paul?
This is WS2N, and good topics tonight. Well, recently, Friday, they had an EVA. Tamad Pascat and Shane Kimbo. Tamad from the European Space Agency, ESA, and Shane Kimbo from NASA. Did an EVA, and it's one of three EVAs that they'll be doing over the next 3 or 4 weeks. And the idea is to get ready to relocate one of the modules, the pressure mating adapter number 3, which is located in a spot that's really unusable. They need to relocate that to the space portion or the Zenith portion of the Harmony module to permanently locate it there. This way, next year when they send up another docking adapter, an ITER, an international docking adapter, on a SpaceX vehicle, they'll be able to attach it to the PMA-3 module piece. Let me drop it. But it takes really four types of moves that have to be done. Three EVAs and one robotic arm moved by the ground in Houston. So the first EVA is complete, which amounts to disconnecting heating connections and cable connections to the PMA-3 docking module. And disconnect everything and get that ready for the robotic arm. And they did some other tasks while they were out there. Had to grease the end effector on the Dextra robotic connection that connects the robotic arm. That's the thing that's going to grab the PMA-3. That's been getting a little tired. They've greased that type of thing before. But over time, it has to be done again. So they did that. They changed out a couple of cameras. Not that the cameras were bad, but the cameras and lights are located in the same unit. And the lights failed. So they had to change that out. They had to change out both light and camera to make that work. Fun to watch because they changed it out, and about an hour later after that was changed out, the astronauts are working on something else. They got the camera working, you know, the ground there. Control it at Houston. Turn it on, and they let them know it's working. So once the PMA-3 gets moved over to the Harmony module, they'll do another EVA probably end of next week or so, and then another one after that to reconnect data lines and power lines, and they have to relocate covers, put another cover, a blank on the end of the port that they just disconnected from. They disconnected from one of the common berthing mechanism ports, and that has to be covered up for micrometeorite protection and, you know, all of that. So that should be pretty interesting. Once that's done, the other one is done. There'll be two docking ports. The other one was completed last year. They got the other, you know, the first PMA, it's called PMA number 2, completely done. They have the IDA, the International Docking Adapter, attached to it, and that's ready to go to accept commercial spacecraft. They need these IDAs and PMAs located in the right place, because commercial traffic will be coming up there probably within a year or so. Between the Dragon spacecraft, that'll have an ITER adapter on the end of that for docking, and the Starliner from Boeing, which is also being built, and that should be ready next year as well. So they'll have the capability of, on the United States and the ESA portion of the International Space Station, of docking two manned vehicles if they like. Each one probably will have about 4 people on board. And also they'll have the capability, they actually have the capability now of docking 2 cargo vehicles. So you'll be able to have 4, crewed docking vehicles and 2 berthing crewed cargo vehicles attached at the same time. So you have 4 at the front. Russia can do that now. They have 4 ports, and, you know, on their end of it, but they're much smaller. The diameter is not as big. You can't get as big as stuff through. And, so there's a big difference between theirs and ours. Let me drop it. So we'll see how the EVAs work out. I'll follow that next week. Another flight coming up, SES-10, is a satellite that's going to be put into space by SpaceX. Should be going up on the 29th. That's this Wednesday, March 29th, unless it's delayed for some reason, which happens quite a bit. And that's not what I'm looking forward to. It actually has been delayed, you know, in the past week or two. And that's going to go to geosynchronous orbit and be put up by SSL, the company that puts up, they must have 50 of these things in geosynchronous orbit. They'll have that up and running I think it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon, if I'm not mistaken. I'll have to double check the time. But what's interesting about that flight, that booster that they're using, will be the first one that's actually reused. I mentioned this probably last week and the week before. SpaceX launched the Falcon 9 rocket, will be launching this STS-10 mission. Their goal is to make space flight very cheap. And the way they're going to do that is by saving these boosters. They've successfully have saved 8 boosters so far. They're starting to add up. And eventually they're going to need a lot more room to store these things. For now, they're going to launch this thing and hopefully successfully be able to use it again to put a satellite into geosynchronous orbit. And this booster is also going to be saved. They're going to have a barge out in the Atlantic Ocean, and they're going to try to successfully land that in the Atlantic Ocean on that barge. Let me drop it. A few more things taking place around Mars. There's many satellites, about 7 operating satellites in orbit around Mars. And there's 2 ones on the planet itself that are driving around. And one of those satellites in orbit is by the European Space Agency, and it's an ExoMars satellite called TRACE. Right now it's in a very highly elliptical orbit. Got there last year. It had a lander with it called Schiaparelli, but unfortunately that lander failed. It tried to make it down to the surface. The radar system made a mistake, and the rocket shut off early and the thing crashed into the Mars surface. But the orbiter is doing good, and TRACE is designed to sniff out methane. A lot of different gases, but the main one is methane. The idea being that, you know, methane could be giving, you know, being created by some kind of life that might still be on Mars, you know, buried under the rocks or something. But it might be also coming from a geological process too. But they aim to find out. But to do that, they've got to get very low into the atmosphere. And they're going to start an aerobraking, or they actually have started aerobraking many, many times. They're going to be doing this because they're starting from a high orbit, 20,000 miles out, and they have a very low perigee right now. But that perigee is going to be even lower, eventually getting down to 70 miles. I think it's around 89 miles right now. So the lower they can get into the Mars atmosphere, the better the methane detectors will work. So we'll both seeing how they work out. The ExoMars TRACE spacecraft. They have a radio on board put on by NASA, so they could actually use that in case they need it as a relay for the existing spacecraft on the planet, or the ones that go up there in the future. The InSight that's going up next year, that's going to land on Mars, or the future Mars rover, the 2020 rover that will be going up, or even communicate with the Dragon crewed vehicle in 2020 if SpaceX has its way. They plan on sending one of their crewed vehicles there without people, but that would be a first to do a propulsive landing on Mars. Let me drop it. Another interesting thing I found on the one of the websites dealing with the European Space Agency, one of their big missions was the Rosetta mission. Rosetta went out to a comet, 67J, and took them probably, I think, around 14 years to do the flight from Earth, go through all their orbits around this comet, and they had a lander, Philippe, and that thing landed, bounced. They eventually heard from it again. Very successful mission. The idea was to really figure out what this comet was like. They had all kinds of scientific instruments on board to do that. But interesting pictures came out recently, roughly about 6 months apart. They took a picture of the same location twice, and they found this million-pound boulder there. I mean, boulders weigh that much. Wound up moving from one location to another. And that's because the comet at one time is getting closer to the sun. And due to the action of the comet, it actually made this big boulder, million-pound boulder, actually move from one location to another. So that was pretty good. You know, they showed you the two pictures, you know, side by side, you know, with arrows pointing to this thing that had moved. A lot of European Space Agency stuff going on. They got an approval, but we have a long wait for this flight. It's called the JUICE mission. Let me drop this. The JUICE mission is a project by the European Space Agency. They plan on sending out to Jupiter, and they want to investigate three of the four Galileo moons, you know, Calypso, Ganymede, and Europa. And JUICE is a strange acronym, but it stands for Jupiter Icy Moons Explorer. So they plan on launching this thing in, I think it's like 2022 or 2023 or something, and it won't get there until, you know, like 5 years later, so maybe 2029 or 2030. But when it does, it will be able to not orbit the planets, but, you know, orbit Jupiter, make these very close passes to the moon. And Russia is trying to get a lander to go along with, you know, go for a ride on this thing. So I don't think that's successful. They have some money problems, I think. Trying to raise money for these missions. Russia does, anyway. But that'll be one of these very large spacecraft. Very big solar panels. I forget how big they're going to be, but when they get to Jupiter, they're going to have 800 watts. So my guess will be twice the size of Juno's panels. Juno's panels are roughly around 120 feet from one end to the other. And it'll probably be bigger because they're going to generate up to 800 watts. Juno does around 400 watts. So, we'll see how JUICE does. Mission's a little, you know, a long way off, but they finally got approval, and that's the reason I bring it up. You know, some of these things are on the drawing board for years, you know, maybe 10 years, some of them like this one. And now they finally get a chance to be developed. This is WS2, let me drop it. Really two other topics. The MLM, Multi-Purpose Logistics Module, that we talked about a week or two ago, is a Russian module, and they've been looking to get it up to the space station probably for the last 10 to 15 years, and there's been delay after delay. The last time they had some kind of contamination, and the tanks were, and the rocket engines were becoming old, and they can't get the new tanks because nobody makes these tanks anymore. So the complicated scheme is, should have been up there in like 2007, here we are 10 years later. And it looked like they were getting ready to launch it by the end of the year. But recently they found more contamination after doing what they did within the tanks and the engines. So I don't know what they're going to do with it. They're talking about possibly scrapping the idea, possibly rebuilding it, and Russia's got long-term plans of building their own space station, and maybe this will become the core of their new space station, and then send up more modules after that. But make a long story short, I think it's for at least many years anyway into the future, I don't think we're going to see that last module go up. And they have plans on getting it attached, and if they did, they were going to bring their Russian crew back up to, you know, three a flight on the Soyuz spacecraft. They go up, you know, for years they've been going up three at a time, and now this last flight, they're going to be going up just two. And they might keep it that way, just two Russians all the time instead of three. They plan on going back up to three of the MLF, you know, they actually call it a Nauka, N-A-U-K-A, the MLM, I always called it that. Nauka is Russian for science, so it's the science module. It's WS2M. One quick topic we talked about. Nova Scotia eventually having a launch site in Canada last week, which is true. They plan on launching a rocket called the Cyclone 4 from that launch complex within a couple of years. Now, not to be outdone, you know, we have plenty of launch sites in the United States. There's another one that just got voted on by the state to start creating a launch complex in the state of Georgia. Georgia voted on it overwhelmingly. You know, they have in the state of Georgia voted like 151 to 306 to create a launch complex in Camden, K-A-M-D-E-N, Georgia. They've talked about it probably for the last 15, 20 years of actually doing something like this. Now they finally got the people to approve it. They plan on going ahead with that. So it's possible that maybe, you know, 4 or 5 years from now, another one is in the state of Georgia. plenty of rockets going up. There's another rocket called the Vector that just made its way to Cape Canaveral. They're going to launch from another launch complex that's being redone called Launch Complex 46. They're actually going to share the launch complex with Orbital ATK. Orbital ATK is going to launch a Minotaur rocket from there. Minotaur 4 rocket, probably about, I don't know, 4 or 5 months or so from now. And then they're going to share it with Vector. Vector is another small orbital rocket company that can launch maybe, you know, 100 to 200 pounds into orbit if they develop their rocket. They plan on launching later on this year. I don't see how they're going to do it, but they've already got a rocket built. They've only started their business a couple of years ago, back in early 2016. So 2015 or so, they started thinking about this rocket company. There's plenty of rockets that might be going up in the next couple of years. This is WS2N. Dick, back over to you. Any questions, comments from anybody or you? Or I'll be here. This is SpaceNet Report 244, part of the TechNet Back User.
Buddy, have a question for Paul? Give me your call letters and name. When it comes to juice, Jupiter Ice Moon Explorer, with its 800 watt solar panels, I am guessing what's going on there, Paul, is that Io, Europa, Ganymede, Callisto, those are the four major big moons around Jupiter that were first discovered by Galileo. And I forget which one. I'm going to guess it's Europa. It seems to have an icy surface, and they believe it's got a fluid underneath the surface. And because of the global warming it gets by being in close orbit around Jupiter, it could be in the Goldilocks zone of temperature. So there could be life in that fluid below the icy surface of that Jupiter moon. Jupiter itself has got an intense Van Allen belt, a lot of local radiation, which would be quite dangerous to life. However, below that icy surface, the ice could be a protective layer, and living material could live below it. And I think, I think some of the past spacecraft have seen water vapor geysers coming out of that icy moon. So I'm guessing the juicy spacecraft is possibly going to be looking for life on that icy moon. Is that part of what's going on here, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I know. They have a lot of instruments on board that they plan on building for this thing. Like at least 10 or 12 instruments. We'll have to see. It's early. But yeah, they're going to be looking at the three moons. I know the fourth Galileo moon. Io, Europa, Callisto, Ganymede. Io is crossed it off. That one off the list. They're going to look at the other three. And they think all three now have some possible water underneath their surfaces. But definitely Europa, they can see the ice faults, from one end of the planet to the other. And they're not the only ones that are going to be going there. We have the Europa Clipper. It should be going there as well in a couple of years. No lander on board. But again, we're going to be sending something in orbit around Jupiter, similar to this. And I think it's 40 some odd different passes that are going to be coming very close to Europa. Again, that one mission is called the Clipper, Europa Clipper. This other one is juiced by European Space Agency, Jupiter Icy Moons Explorer. So they use the J and the U and the I and the C for icy, and then the E for Explorer. So we'll see. Long range development.
Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Drop it. The president just signed the bill, Space Act for NASA. He had everybody there, people that are involved with NASA. He had astronauts there, and there's a signing. Go to the website, you can see this 7-minute video of signing it, talking to the people, and allocates the over $19 billion for NASA for another year. But it also gives them a directive, and he actually read it off, and talking about deep space missions and human flight involved with the commercial flights. They're all going to be funded, as well as read off the SLS, the Space Launch System, and Orion. He mentioned it. Probably. Then they went over to Bill Nelson. Bill Nelson, if nobody knows who he is, he was a congressman at the time, many years ago, back in the 1980s. And now he's a senator of Florida. I drop it. And, of course, he's a Democrat, but he was there with this group. And they all had something to say. And then Trump, he was getting around with them. That he's a Democrat, but, of course, he got the chance to say something. He talked about going to Mars. So, looks good for now.
Mm-hmm.
For space flight, for all the things that we've been talking about on the net. And, yeah, Bill Nelson was he actually was an astronaut during his flight. His flight, he was a congressman for Florida. So he's the only congressman that went up on a space shuttle many, many years ago. And there was a senator, too, at one time. They wanted somebody from both houses, from the Senate, from Congress. But that's how that worked out. But he was actually there now. And of course, he's no kid now. He's really up there. But he's still active as a senator. Back to you, Dick WS1.
Frank, did you want to say something? WB2BXO, K2LIW in the TechNet.
I think you just mentioned, I was wondering what the Trump announcement yesterday related to NASA was all about, and I think that's what Paul is alluding to now. So I think you're answering my question. Thanks.
Yeah, I sure hope, Paul, that Trump, with all his crazy changes, is not decreasing the allocation to NASA. I haven't been keeping track of that, so is he threatening to lower NASA's budget, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
Oh, okay, and that was Frank. Yeah, and if you go to the, well, there's a bunch of sites. I always like to go to the NASA sites. You know why? There's never a commercial. Never a commercial, never an advertisement. And you scroll down to Space Act of 2017, and it'll say video, and you click on it. It's 7 minutes long, and it's pretty interesting. Tracy Dyson is there, an astronaut, and Marco Rubio, and Cruz is heavily involved with the space program, and, you know, one of the people that decides on funding it and all that. And he has a vice president there, and now the vice president always had a role of for many years, he always had the vice president kind of like in charge of NASA, you know, really like a link between the White House and NASA. And they seem to have stopped that for many, many years, but now they're starting that up again, so vice president will be involved with that. And he was there, of course. And as far as, the money, let me drop it. Last year was 0.5 billion or something like that. And they're keeping that number. They're dropping it 0.8%. So, but less than 1% is being dropped. Some of the climate type of satellites, you know, so many of them that NASA's involved with, they're always looking at the ozone and the amount of carbon dioxide that's in the atmosphere, and looking at the seas. There's some of those that are going to be cut. You know, global warming type of projects. But a lot of that money that would have normally gone to that is shifting toward the human flight part of the program. So it should help that. And also, they're keeping a lot of the deep space probe systems like the Jupiter, Europa Express, one of them, I think I mentioned it last week, one they're cutting, which I kind of thought they would anyway. We dropped it. Is this ARM project, A-R-M, it stood for Asteroid Redirect Mission. And like I said last week, and maybe the week before, that was, I think, on its way out anyway. They had a lot of trouble with that, trying to sell that, essentially go out to an asteroid, a big asteroid, with a robotic spacecraft launch with a space launch system, which hasn't flown yet, but launch with that big rocket, which is going to have more, eventually, more power than the Saturn V that sent people to the moon. You take this big robotic craft, go out to an asteroid, go right down near the surface, these big claws that are, they look like, I don't know, 100-foot towers, radio towers sticking me at the end of this thing. They would grab a boulder from a 30-foot diameter boulder from the surface, and then fly away from the big asteroid and bring it back to the moon and put it into orbit around the moon, drop it. After that was done, a couple of years later, you'd send another space launch system up with just two astronauts in it, in the Orion command module, and you fly out, go into orbit around the moon, and meet up with this flying asteroid, do an EVA, go out there with a hammer and chisel off a couple of big rocks from this thing, bring it back to the Orion spacecraft, fly all the way back to Earth, leaving this other thing, this other piece of an asteroid in orbit around the moon. I just was not crazy about the whole idea, and I'm kind of glad they canceled it. Back to you, Dick. WS.
If your main purpose is to get a chunk of that asteroid, because it's a very old natural object around the sun, and it contains minerals and whatever, showing you something about what the early sun was like, you would think you would get more bang for the dollar by sending a spacecraft to the asteroid. The asteroid is a robot which chips off a chunk of the asteroid and brings that chunk directly back to the Earth. This redirect mission strikes me as a hard way to go. You get more material, but it's a hard way to go, and I don't think you need human intervention. To bring astronauts up to a lunar orbit to meet up with an asteroid, just to chip off a chunk and bring it back home, when you consider the 10 times more cost required to keep humans alive on a spacecraft as opposed to it being a robotic mission, I'm convinced you get a lot more bang for the money out of a pure robot mission. You might have some opinions on that, Paul. Over to you, K2LIW.
Yeah, I know we're going to have the space launch system ready way early before they're ready to go to Mars. I mean, the idea is build the Orion spacecraft, build the space launch system, which is going to be able to put, in the beginning, 70 tons of stuff into orbit if you wanted, but eventually up to 135 tons. You'd have this complex system built, ready to go, and yet, you know, you don't have a habitat to put inside the space launch system for the people to go into on their way to Mars. You don't have a lander to get down to the planet of Mars. You don't have a way back up to fly home from Mars. So they were way early, you know. Maybe if you could send somebody to Mars and bring them back by, say, 2022 or 2023. Yeah, it would have been okay to do that. But now that they're going to have this big rocket ready, Orion's going to be ready. No habitat module probably yet. So, you know, they were, I think, cooking up an idea. What can we use this for? I got an idea. Let's go out to an asteroid and bring a piece back. I think that's probably how it started. but that's not a good idea. The question is, what are they going to do with the space launch system and the Orion spacecraft? And now Lockheed is developing a habitat module. I think they're gonna, you're going to find an outpost eventually. Space station orbiting the moon. I think that's
repeater timeout. Repeater timeout. Cancel.
They can get themselves to Mars and back. Back to you, Dick. WS2.
The Lockheed Habitat module. Has that project begun? When is it proposed to be finished? And Lockheed is building a habitat module to be applied where? If they're building it for Mars, I am of the opinion they're wasting their time. Over to you, Paul, KGRIW.
I know they're designing it, you know, their version of it, but no, there's no hardware yet, no funding approved for it yet. I think that's coming, but it might not be a Lockheed design. Orbital ATK would love to have their Cygnus spacecraft. Strip it out. Don't make it a cargo vehicle anymore. It's already equipped for people when they send it to the space station. It's got heaters in it. Able to create your own atmosphere in there. You know, it's ready to go. They have plans. I've seen animations of it where Orbital ATK would launch a couple of these enhanced Cygnus extra cargo type of vehicles out to the moon, have them dock with one another with docking collars on there, IDA docking collars, international docking adapters, and you'll be able to send men out there and eventually cargo out, dock to one or the other. One of the docking ports, and you would be able to have people in orbit around the moon. I would think that it would probably be the next move, and what is Lockheed doing? Well, they have plans, but you will need a habitat module sooner or later to get to Mars. You can't put four people in front of this capsule and leave them there for 6 months as they fly all the way to Mars. Back to there.
But the total radiation dose you get on the way to and from Mars has already been estimated to be so high, there is no reasonable way to protect you from that radiation dose. You can't put enough mass on board to act as a shield. And to put a human being on the surface of Mars, which is so inhospitable, with no magnetic field, no atmosphere, no ionosphere, no Van Allen belt. All of these things are protective shields for human beings down on the surface of Earth. And even if you get a habitat on the surface of Mars, you can put human beings in that habitat, they're going to get claustrophobia and I forget what disease they call that when you have to spend a winter inside of an enclosure at the Antarctic. You get some real cabin fever. So to just be inside of a habitation module on the surface of Mars, that's not going to be any fun for more than the first couple of hours, the first day or two. And to go out beyond the habitat module, let me drop it. You have to do it with an EVA spacesuit. And you're not going to want to spend very much time in an EVA spacesuit. And it's a very dangerous maneuver. There's only 10 ways that spacesuit can kill you if everything doesn't work just right. And if you're spending any significant amount of time in that spacesuit, you're going to get a whole lot of diaper rash. And to grow plants, to set up a garden on Mars, it's so difficult. There's so many things that are going to stop you from doing that. And if you can't grow your own food, then you need a tremendous amount of consumable supplies to support a human being. A human being uses 8 gigajoules of energy per year. 4 gigajoules of energy per year. 127 watts. of energy is burned by your metabolism system 24/7, 365 days a year. Continuous 127 watts must be supplied to a human being to keep you alive. It turns out to be 4 gigajoules for one human being for 1 year. So maintaining life off of this surface of this earth for any substantial amount of time in days is a huge endeavor for a whole bunch of reasons. I'm of the opinion that the cost involved, the trillions of dollars, and the risk involved, and the radiation involved is such that our grandchildren, it is my belief, are not going to see the day when a human being is standing on the surface of Mars. That's my belief. I've given you some of the reasons of why. Somebody might want to add some questions or comments to the above, so I'll...
Repeater, time out.
I'll turn it over for comments right now, and after that, you pick it up, Paul. So, comments first, and then WS2N if there aren't any. K2LIW in the tech net.
I don't hear anything. I know there's a company developing like a body suit that you can wear inside the spacecraft itself. It's called Astrorad. Astrorad Radiation Shield. And they've been producing things like this to protect workers working at that nuclear plant that they had problems with during the tsunami in Japan, Fujiami. You know, they have this material that they're using. I haven't read what it's made out of yet, but it's protecting their organs. And, they have a contract with NASA now. They're involved with them. They try to have this form-fitting bodysuit. It doesn't like cover your arms or legs or anything, but your whole body, your chest, your organs. You know, that's one of the things they're working on outside of taking a lot of the water that you have in a spacecraft, those bags of water, locate them on one side of the vehicle. And this way, when there's solar radiation coming from the sun, that would act like a wall deflecting a lot of it coming into the spacecraft. So there's some of the things I've read about. Well, you know, we're going to have to wait and see. Let me drop it. One of the things that they signed during this bill in this act, this 2017 act for NASA, that the president signed, was to have permanent evaluation of all astronauts when they come back from wherever they're coming back from, even the ones now. It was a situation where, you know, NASA would always evaluate them, you know, years later, but they would always say, you know, go see your own doc, you know, give us an update, you know. This way there, NASA will be directly involved with these people's health, because, you know, you could have some kind of radiation affect you, and you don't know it for 10, 15, 20 years down the road, and then what do you do? So you'll have a permanent health care from NASA, you know, from the NASA budget into the future. I thought that was pretty good. So I don't know. I think I just think there's going to be lunar orbiting space stations, not permanently manned, but temporarily manned, you know, intermittently. And I think that's going to happen. Then eventually you'll see people going back down to the surface, probably near the poles, finding locations, maybe an old lava tube. They talk about, you know, that they know where these lava tubes are on the moon, and you might be able to protect yourself in there. We talked about the heat and the cold earlier in the net. Yeah, it's true. it was always like morning when they would do these landings, and they had, you know, 3-4 days at the most, and they didn't have